Happy Mother's Day. Good morning, everybody. Great to see you. So glad that you're here today, especially on this day that we get to set aside every year to honor all the moms in the room and in our lives and all the women that have maybe even stepped into the role of offering mentorship and mothering to us along the way. I know probably more than any other day, today's a day that there's a lot of different emotions that happen on Mother's Day, from all those excited first-time moms in the room to maybe others that are here really missing someone today, and so it's exciting, but it's also a little sad. All of those that are hopeful for what one day maybe God will bring into their lives, all of that today I know is in the room, and so we want to obviously and very genuinely be sensitive to everybody that's here, and at the same time, we want to honor all the ladies that have just stepped into that role, mentoring and loving and serving and helping us become the men and women and children and teenagers that we are today. So moms, we just will say thank you. We love you. God bless you. Can we give all the moms can we just honor the women in our lives that have spent so much time with us? On this day, I feel like it's an interesting statement. One of the most interesting scriptures in the Old Testament to me is the way that Isaiah describes the way that God will comfort us. He says it this way in Isaiah. He says, as a mother comforts her child, so will I comfort you. The reason I find it interesting is that God throughout the scriptures referred to as our father, and yet he says he's going to comfort us like our mother. And I think that's because God understands us, because can you imagine if he says, as a father comforts his child, so will I comfort you. You fell off the bike, suck it up, get back on the bike, you broke an arm, whatever, it's fine. I mean, that's the way as dads we comfort people, right? And so as a mother comforts her child, so God will comfort you. That's for free, by the way, today. So I just thought that would be an encouragement to you that God comforts us as a mother does. Anyway, hey, today we are continuing on in our series as we've been talking about the statements, seven statements in the Gospel of John that Jesus made about himself. We're calling this series, I Am Jesus, because we want to get a better picture of who Jesus said that he is and not just who we think he is, because I found and I absolutely believe that one of the reasons a lot of people don't want a lot to do with Jesus or maybe kind of stand on the fringes of Christianity looking in is because they have an idea or a perception of who God is and what church is about, and specifically who Jesus is, that maybe was formed by some inaccurate information. Maybe it's because of some well-meaning person kind of painted a bad picture of who God was to them unintentionally. Maybe somebody did it self-righteously. I don't know. There's a lot of misinformation out there. But we want to talk a lot about who Jesus is, who Jesus said he is, because as you look, and I've said this every week, a lot of people know some of the things that Jesus did, right? And we're familiar with some of those. We're familiar with the stories, maybe some of the miracles that he performed. Some of them we're a bigger fan of than others. Like I said last week, maybe you've been waiting and praying that Jesus' very first miracle would be a miracle he'd perform in your house and change some water to wine, but it hasn't happened yet, right? So we know some of the things that he's done, some of the stories about him. We know what Jesus did, but what Jesus did is not even as important as who he is, because who Jesus is what enabled him to do the things that he did. And it's what gives power and authority to the things that he did and what makes it life-changing. And I absolutely believe that if we had a deeper understanding of who Jesus is as a person, as God, that we would have more confidence in what it is he did and accomplished on our behalf. So we've been looking at these seven statements. I'm the bread of life. I'm the resurrection and the life. I am the light of the world. We talked about last week. And last week, when we looked at this idea that Jesus is the light of the world, what we found is that when he says that, what he meant by that is that when Jesus' grace falls on us, that a couple things happen when his grace falls on us. He accepts us and receives us just as we are, but then he also shines his light into us and shines his light on our darkness. And what that means is that even though he accepts us right as we are, he wants to bring to the surface, into the light, the things in us that honestly we would like to keep hidden. And so what that means, and again, I've said this for the last few weeks, is that when you follow Jesus, what you'll realize is that he will begin to show you some things that you need to know, but you don't always want to hear. The things that we need to know but don't want to hear. That's what happens when he shines his light in us. For example, if you've ever gotten on the scale and it read more than you thought it would, that's some information you needed to know but didn't want to hear. Correct? Okay, and it's good that you now know that information. Or maybe you opened up your credit card bill and that balance was quite a bit higher than you thought it was going to be. You need to know that, but you didn't want to hear that. And the same thing is true in our relationship with God. Jesus is going to shine a light into the darkness of our lives, bring to the surface the things that maybe we don't even want to really hear him say to us, but we need to know him, and he's going to shine a light on those things, not to guilt us, not to shame us or embarrass us, but to set us free. And so the reason I just review all of that is because the statement we're going to look at today of who Jesus said he is and what Jesus says about himself, I think might be one of those statements that more people do not want to hear than any other statement that Jesus made about himself. In fact, I think it is probably, today's statement is the most polarizing of all the I am statements. And I think the reason it's the most polarizing of all the statements is actually because it is the most misunderstood of all the I am statements. And then here's the statement, it's found in Gospel of John chapter 14. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Many people find this statement to be, just quite honestly, those outside of Christianity, and even some of those inside Christianity I've talked to, find this statement to be maybe one of the most offensive things that Jesus ever said. Because it just screams exclusivity. It screams that some people are in, some people are out. And the idea that Jesus is the only way to God just doesn't make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And I've heard people say, hey, you know, to understand Jesus as a way to God, all right, I can go there. Or Jesus is one of the ways to heaven, all right, sure, I can deal with that. But to say that he is the way, the only way, and no one can come except through him, it just seems to be such an arrogant, exclusive, self-righteous, very non-inclusive kind of a thing to say, and especially for God to say about himself if God truly is a loving God. And so here's what I want to try and do this morning. I'm going to try in the best way I can to show you why not only is it not arrogant and self-righteous for Jesus to say this and for Christianity to believe this. It's actually the opposite, and it is actually the only thing that can be true. That's my goal for today, and we'll see if I have the ability to pull that off. So anyway, see if we can delve into that this morning. What a light subject to have on Mother's Day, right? So anyway, happy Mother's Day. Aren't you glad you're at the Church of South Lake? All right, so here's what we're going to do. Before we jump into the first phrase of I am the way, which is honestly one of the more difficult to grasp statements in that for some people, I want to kind of jump to the end of that and kind of work our way backwards. Let's start with what Jesus meant when he says, I am the life. We started this series on Easter, if you were here. And on that Sunday, we talked about the story of Lazarus. Lazarus, his sisters Martha and Mary. And Lazarus, if you remember in John chapter 11, Lazarus gets sick. The sisters send word to Jesus that he's ill. They invite Jesus to come because he's ill, believing that Jesus can heal him. And apparently, they know that it's bad, and they send word to Jesus. And when he gets word that Lazarus is sick, remember what he does? He waits 2 days. He waits 2 days before he goes anywhere. And so a couple days later, he finally shows up. And by the time Jesus gets to Bethany, Lazarus is already dead. And Martha runs out and says to him, "Why did you not come? Why were you not here? If you'd have been here, my brother would not have died." And then she says something to Jesus. Says, "You know, I believe that maybe in the last day that he will be raised. But what about today? And what about here and now?" And if you remember, here's what Jesus said to Martha after she says, "Hey, one day in the future, on the last day, I believe my brother would rise, but right now I have no hope." Here's what he says to her. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." And if you think back, one of the points I made was that Jesus does not say, "I'm going to pull off a resurrection and bring him back to life." He doesn't say that I can lead you or point you to life and to one day a resurrection from the dead. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." That's fundamental to who I am, my person, my being. I am life. I am the one that raises what is dead. I am what brings back to life things that have died. I am resurrection. I am life. I'm not just pointing you to it. That's who I actually am. Now, he also says in that verse that we read a moment ago, "I am the truth. I'm the way, the truth, and the life." Jesus claimed to be the truth. Now, what does that mean? In Mark chapter 2, we find a story early on in Jesus' ministry. He's walking through a field one day with his disciples, and it's the Sabbath. And on the Sabbath, you know, I've shared this many times, there's a lot of rules about what you can and cannot do on the Sabbath day. And one of the primary things you cannot do on the Sabbath day is you cannot work. And there was a lot of definition about what work was and what it was not. And so Jesus is walking through the field, and he and his disciples begin to grab some grain and to eat because they're hungry. And the Pharisees are kind of taking note and watching, and they're complaining to Jesus, "Why are you working? You're not supposed to work. It's the Sabbath." You're supposed to rest on the Sabbath. The Sabbath day was made to rest. It's a holy day. We have to keep this holy day and rest on this holy day. That's what this holy day is for. And then Jesus makes one of the most straightforward, important statements about the Sabbath to them in that moment. In Mark chapter 2, he says to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. In other words, God did not, in the beginning, create the world and create life and create a day and dedicate it to be holy and then decide, now I need to make man so I have somebody to keep this holy day. That's not the way that it happened. That was not the process. The process was God created man, and knowing how he created you and I, he created a day of rest and gave it to us as a gift. The Sabbath was made for man to find rest. The Sabbath was made for man to reflect and to renew, and to be rejuvenated by finding rest on the Sabbath day. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And oh yeah, by the way, the Son of Man, that's me, is actually Lord of the Sabbath. In other words, Jesus says, the Sabbath day, the reason I know it was made for you and you weren't made for it is because I made it. I'm the author of the Sabbath. It was my idea. I created it. I authorized it. I put it in place. I'm Lord of the Sabbath. I gave it to you as a gift. I'm its source, I'm its author, and I also am the one in which you will find your ultimate rest. Your Sabbath day wasn't pointing just a day to take off and catch up on some sleep. It actually was always intended to point to me as the one in whom you will find true rest. So I am the life, I'm also the truth. And this idea of truth in the Hebrew culture was very deeply ingrained. In Hebrew philosophy and in wisdom literature, for example, and not just the Hebrew wisdom literature, most Eastern philosophies in wisdom literature was this way. They would talk about the depth of wisdom and truth in terms of the heaviness of its yoke. Right? So it's different philosophies, different religions, different ideas would have different weighted yokes. Some yokes were heavier, some yokes were lighter. Right, and depending on the kind of truth that it was. And along that line, here's what Jesus said about this idea of truth. And something else that he said in Matthew records this. He tells us to take his yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What I'm saying, very, very simply, and what Jesus, I think, is saying is this, that I did not come to point you towards truth. I did not come to point you towards life. I came to be truth, and I came to be life. Like I didn't come to just show you the way to something and the road to something and to give you an opportunity to understand more of how the world's wired and how you're wired and all of that. I didn't come to just direct you towards what is true and direct you towards what is life because I've got some insight that you don't have. I came because I am that truth. I am that life. That's fundamental to who I am. In other words, here's what I'm getting at. Jesus' goal when he was here was never about pointing us toward something. It was always to show us how he was that something. And you get the difference? I mean, I'm a teacher. What I'm doing this morning is I'm here teaching, explaining, trying to point you towards something. I'm trying to lead you towards something. That is not what Jesus did when he was here. He did not come saying, I've got some great insight. You're going to want to hear this. It'll really help you down the road. Jesus didn't come pointing us towards something. He came to show us that he was that something that we were looking for. He was it. That's who he was, fundamental to who he was. I didn't come to just point you towards life. I came to show you that I am life and that I am your life. I didn't come to point you towards wisdom and truth. I came to show you that I am wisdom and truth. I didn't come to just show you how your life could be lived in a restful, peaceful way. I came to be that peace and to be your rest. And so when we go back to that verse we're looking at today in John 14, when Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. Like no one comes to the Father. I am the way, the truth, and life. If you're really going to understand what Jesus meant by this statement and be able to not see it as just some exclusive boys club or girls club or whatever else that some are in and some are out, and you're going to be able to look at this in any sense of honesty and see that it's not arrogant and self-righteous, it's actually the only way that it can be, there is a fundamental question you have to answer. And the question you have to answer is this: Jesus is the way to what? If Jesus is the way, and if it's not arrogant or self-righteous or exclusive for Jesus to say that I'm the way in terms of he's trying to keep some people out and let some people in, you've got to understand, what is it Jesus is the way to? What he's the way to what? See, I'm convinced about something. I'm convinced that when it comes to this whole idea of salvation and heaven and afterlife and what's out there after all of this, I'm convinced when it comes to religion and God and Jesus and the gospel and all of this, what most people want to know, all they really want to know and all they really care about is what are the minimum entrance requirements to get into heaven? I mean, really, this is the way we normally think about it. And I think for most of us, this is really what we're after. Like what's the bottom score I got to get and we got to be able to pass on this test? Okay, I got a son about to graduate high school, and sometimes I feel like that's kind of his MO in school all the way through. Is what's the minimum I got to do to be able to skate by? And unfortunately, he kind of gets that, honestly, from his dad, because my motto was C's get degrees. So why work and get an A when I can coast and get it anyway? So sorry, moms. I shouldn't have said that on Mother's Day if you have teenagers sitting next to you. But anyway, we think about this. Like, how can I skate by, even if it's by the skin of my teeth, as long as I'm in, I'm good. How do I get to the good place? You know, there's a good place and a bad place, and I just want to be in the good place. There's actually a TV show called The Good Place. Anybody ever watch that show? It's a great show. I would not suggest watching it to kind of derive your theology of heaven and hell from this TV show, all right? But it's actually kind of an interesting idea. And basically, there's this main character, her name's Eleanor, who wakes up one day and finds out that she's in the good place. And she's kind of surprised that she's in the good place because she wasn't all that great of a person, and she's in the good place. But by the end of that kind of first episode, she figures out she's in the good place by mistake. She's supposed to be in the bad place, but she made it to the good place. And so now she's trying to keep a secret under wraps so that nobody finds out that she's there, not supposed to be there. And by the end of it, if you've not seen it, sorry, little spoiler alert. By the end of the first season, what you actually find out is that she's not in the good place. She's actually in the bad place that's masquerading as the good place. And they've taken, the reason it's the bad place is because they've taken people that will drive you crazy and put you together as a couple for all of eternity. That's why it's the bad place, and you think it's a good place, right? So that's Hollywood's version of hell, apparently. Although, truth be told, if I was eternally with a couple of, there's people that I might think that was hell. Anyway, I'm sorry. But I just let that lie. I should have just gone right past that. But this is kind of our idea, like, how do I get to the good place? And if we think of what Jesus is saying, that he's the way to the good place, but the only way you get to the good place is by him, and that's the ultimate objective, is to get to the end of your life and end up in the good place and not the bad place, then yes, Jesus' statement that only through him do you get to the good place, I get where you could say that seems extremely exclusive and arrogant and unloving and uncaring. Because, again, the way we somehow, for whatever reason, tend to think of it is, what's the minimum entrance requirements? Kind of like if you're in college, you know, if you're in a sorority or fraternity, you know, a fraternity, I was in a fraternity in college, and it's all about, like, who's in and who's not in. And there's pledge weeks, and there's choosing, and there's rejecting, and there's groups you wanted to get in, and they didn't accept you, and this one did, and which one are you going to pledge to be a part of? How do I get in? And then once you get in, you got like your little group and you're sitting at your table, you know, with your group, and you're not going to associate with those guys over there because, you know, they're different than our group. And I went to a Christian university, and there were several fraternities and sororities, and there was one in particular that was kind of known as the rowdy guys and the partiers and kind of the troublemakers. And, you know, if they're going to get into trouble, it's going to be, you knew that's the fraternity that you wanted to be in. A true story, the other day, I'm in Starbucks, grabbing a cup of coffee, waiting for my order, and standing there, and I look over, and there's a college student wearing the Greek letters of that other fraternity from my college. You know, it's a national fraternity, so he's a part of this particular fraternity. And I remember looking over and thinking, oh, immediately in my mind, I was like, oh, that's like a party dude right there, you know? I don't know who this kid is. I was like, wow, that's been 30 years since I've been in college, and I'm just naturally, like, thinking of who's in what camp, because we think about it, like, what does it mean to get in? Right before Jesus makes the statement that I'm the way, the truth, and the life, I want you to look at what he says. Because remember, important to understand context here. Jesus is just about to go to the cross. They're finishing up the Last Supper, the Passover meal. They're finishing that up. And Judas is going to be betraying, and all of this is happening, and Jesus has used all of this language, and they know something's coming to the end, and they are getting pretty clear. He's saying he's about to die. They don't really get it all quite yet, but they're starting to figure it out. They're starting to get kind of anxious and a little bit worried, and here's what Jesus says to them. Right before he says, I'm the way and the truth and the life, this is what he says. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? See, I think this is maybe part of the reason why we get this idea of one day, like it's just about getting in and going somewhere and getting to the good place. Because, you know, we think about this, like in my Father's house, there's a lot of rooms. And we think of the end goal of Christianity being to get us across the finish line. There's even lots of songs that are written about that. I mean, Brad Paisley, a great country musician, he's got a song, When I Get Where I'm Going. Right, there's only going to be happy tears. I'm going to shed all the sins and struggles that have kind of weighted me down and plugged me all of these years. In the 90s, it wasn't Brad Paisley. It was Audio Adrenaline with Big House. All right, where's all my Big House peeps? You know that song? Yeah, some of you are like, what? Yeah, no. Talked about heaven in terms of it's a big house. Lots and lots of room, big table, lots of food, big yard where we're going to play football, where the Gators will eternally beat Florida State. It's just a wonderful, right? At least that's my version of heaven, at least, right? Okay. And so again, this is the idea where we get like my Father, he's created this house for me, and there's this place I'm trying to get to, this good place. And so what are the minimum entrance requirements to get over there to the good place? And while Jesus certainly used this language of a place, I want you to look at what he says next about this. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. You see, the reason it's not arrogant or exclusive or uninclusive for Jesus to say he's the only way to the good place is because the good place is not so much about a place as it is about a person. And the point of the place is a person, and the person is Jesus. And so when Jesus says, I'm the way, right after this, that's what he says. Right after this is when he says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus is the way to the Father. Well, why do I say Jesus is actually the point of the place? Because Jesus also said, I and the Father are one. And so it's not Jesus trying to lower the, kind of limit the playing field and limit the opportunities and saying, look, I'm going to make it really complicated and really difficult for anybody to get in and make it to the good place. That's not what he's trying to do. What Jesus is saying is that the point of the place is a person, and I'm the person, and therefore I am the only one that can take you to me. I'm going to take you to me. And the reason I'm the only one that can take you to me is because I am truth. I am life. I am. And because I am, I can, and I'm going to take you, and only I can take you. And where am I going to take you? To the place where I am, so that where I am, you may be also. Because I am the way, the truth, and the life. Everybody has a truth that they choose to live their life for. All of us in this room, all of us that are not in this room, all people everywhere, there is some truth that we all choose to live our lives for. But here's the problem with that truth. Whatever truth you decide and choose to live for, it has some things that it cannot do. That truth that you choose to live for, again, Christian, not, you don't have to, I'm not talking religion, I'm just talking what you're going to base and bank your life on. A truth cannot do several things. For one, a truth cannot love you. Just a truth, and there's lots of truths, like 2 + 2 = 4, that's a truth. I don't know why you'd want to bank your life and base your life on that truth, but you could if you wanted to, right? There's lots of philosophies that have lots of truths in them that don't have anything at all to do with Jesus and nothing at all to do with God. But they have truth. I mean, you do recognize that, right? I mean, Christianity is not the sole bearer of everything that is true in the world. There's lots of truths that people that don't follow Jesus know and understand. And you can choose to build your life upon that if you want to. But the problem with that truth is that it can't love you. It can't forgive you. It can only do one thing for you. It can only demand from you. It can demand that you obey it. It can demand that you serve it. It can demand that you live up to a certain standard. And do you know what
you will do with the demands of that truth, whatever truth you decide to build your life upon, you will fail. You're going to fail. And when you fail, here's the thing with that truth. It cannot pick you up. It cannot wipe your tears. It cannot say you're forgiven because it is a thing. It is an abstraction. So what do you do? You know what I think most people do? We kind of decide at some point we're just going to get rid of truth then and we're going to pursue love. Because love, that's where it's at. It's all about love. And so we begin to bank and build our life upon love. We get rid of truth and we seek love. And so we turn to people, we turn to friends, we turn to family. Most likely at some point we're going to turn to romance. And here's in the end what we find even there, that even if we find someone that we think, man, this person is it, they are the one, they're the everything I ever hoped they would be, at some point they're going to disappoint also because they are not fully true. They're not perfect. They are flawed just like you, just like me. Eventually, that love, if you're not careful, will destroy you. And here's the reason why. And I love the way Tim Keller writes about this. He says it this way, that just as truth cannot love us, our loves are not true. Just as truth cannot love us, our loves are not true. And the reason our loves are not true is because they're flawed, because you and I are flawed. But here's the beauty of what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying that in him, truth has become a person. And not just any person, a perfect person. And truth has become a person that can love you. Truth has become a person that can hug you. Truth has become a person that when you violate even his truth, that can pick you up and forgive you and redeem you and hold you fast. In Jesus, you finally have a love that is true because you finally have a truth that can love you. Because love and truth have become a person, and the person is the meaning of life, is your life. And that life is Jesus. This is the love to which all other loves point. This is the truth to which all other truths point. This is the life that our lives were meant to live out. And it's not just to arrive at a place and a destination one day. It's that he would take you ultimately one day to a place that is about a person, and the person is him. Now, I'll tell you something that's coming later in the year, most likely in August. I've been reading and studying and preparing a lot of stuff on this. In the month of August, most likely, we're going to delve in to what does it really mean to be a Christian, because Jesus never asked anyone to be a Christian. He asked us to be something different, and we're going to delve into what that really, really means in the month of August. But for today, my hope is that you can begin to see that when Jesus says he's the way, the truth, and the life, it's not because he's trying to limit who can be in and who's out. It's not because he doesn't care about some people and cares more about others. It's because in the end, he's trying to lead us to a place that is about a person, and he's the person, and he's the only one that can lead us to him. Jesus is the way to him because he's the point. And it's actually, I believe, one of the most caring, grace-filled, loving things Jesus could ever say, to look at us, whom he created in his image, that rebelled against him, and to say, listen, I know you've fallen, and I know you're broken, and I know you don't want me right now, but I want you, and I'm going to provide a way for you. I'm going to be your way to come back to me. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I want to ask you to bow your heads with me, if you would, and I want to pray for us this morning. But specifically, I want to pray that these words and this idea and this subject would resonate with all of us in here. And maybe you're here this morning and you have never thought of Jesus' words in quite that way. In fact, you might be here this morning and maybe the reason you're not a Christian and you don't show up at church very often, you're just here maybe because it's Mother's Day, maybe the reason you don't come is because of verses like that and ideas like that and statements like that. This seems like Christianity just wants a few people in and wants to keep other people out. It's completely opposite of that. Jesus says, I'm going to provide a way for you to know me. Because I am the point. I am life. I am truth. And I'm the way that you come to my life in truth. And if you've never opened up your heart to that and your life to that, friend, I pray that you would this morning. In the simplest of ways, even without understanding all of it, if you maybe just say, God, I there's a lot I don't yet get, and there's a lot I don't understand, but I want to know you. Be my way. Father, thank you. Thank you for the ability we have to reach out to you, not because we're good, not because we are deserving, but because Jesus provided a way, the way, for us to come to him and to you. God, I pray that our confidence would grow as Christians in what Jesus did for us on that cross and what he did when he was raised from that grave, that he provided the way not just to join a club and not just to be in an exclusive group, but he provided the way for us to come to you, to him, and spend eternity with you that begins here and now. God, my prayer is that we would see this understanding of Jesus for what it is, one of the greatest gifts you ever gave, in your son Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.